So welcome to News Club for the second time. I'm your host, Em, and this is where we talk about the news and what to do about it. I'm joined today by Debs and B. Chivers is ill, which means it's going to be a shorter one. It's okay. It's okay, though. So let's start off with Google. Why are we talking about Google?
So Google is being taken to court in the US in two separate cases around it being a monopoly. And they're utilizing antitrust laws, which are basically laws used to break up monopolies, particularly in the early part of the 20th century in America. They're being taken to court and seem to be guaranteed to be found guilty. In fact, in one case, they already have been, and they're now going into the appeals process of being guilty of being a monopoly. And in the UK, a similar investigation is being undergone around it being considered to have strategic market status. This is something we might have talked about previously on the podcast, where strategic market status means it's essentially got like a monopoly over a particular area of the market, right? And when you think about Google, it used to be about 92% of all web searches started with Google. I think it's gone down to 90% now. I'm not entirely sure that it, please do check those things out, but ballpark, broadly speaking, those are correct figures. What does that mean for you and me is like a really interesting question, because it's really hard to think of a piece of technology as a monopoly when it's ubiquitous and it sort of just seems to work. Actually, one of the real problems with Google is it's actually quite good in comparison to a lot of the other big tech, you know, a lot of the Meta stuff, like Facebook's rubbish. Instagram is always annoying people, you know what I mean? Twitter's drives people balmy, but Google search kind of still does well what it used to do. I mean, it's actually gotten worse recently, but for a long time it's done what people wanted. It was probably the best search engine. So then you're like, well, what's the problem with it being a monopoly then? You know, and so I try and take people back to like natural monopolies, right? Like when we think about like on an island like Britain, our transport infrastructure, like our buses and trains, right? That's a natural monopoly that they were originally created by the private sector. But then we said, actually, everyone needs access to these and they need to be coordinated centrally for the benefit of everyone. And so we took them into public ownership and we did the same thing with water and we did the same thing with energy and we did the same thing with anything that we found was like an important service that everyone used or pretty much had to use. In the information age, we need access to information. So everyone has to use Google. If 92% of us or 90% of us are using Google to get information about the world, then it's basically a monopoly. And what is happening here is that the courts are recognizing, that's the company that has the monopoly. Now, in previous eras, like if you look at trains, there was actually several companies, but we said that overall access to railways was necessary to everyone. So we brought it into public ownership and then it got privatized. And now we're going to bring it back into public ownership because guess what? Privatization sucks, right? And that's a discussion. But the other really interesting discussion for me is instead of breaking up Google, which is what the American courts are going to try and do, they're going to try and say at the moment they've got a contract with Apple where Google Chrome is preloaded onto Apple phones as the default search engine, right? And they're saying, right, we're going to separate out some of your services. So, you know, Chrome isn't attached to Google Workspace and so forth. You're going to have to sell things off. Why don't we say instead it's a really good service, but it should just be brought into public ownership and should serve the public rather than private interests? Because in fact, you know, to use that great word, in shitification, the reason why Google is slowly becoming shitter, right, is because it's having to profit seek. And like, there's no more profits to get, right? Like it's got the monopoly. There's not any more market to grow. So now what it has to do is make its product worse to extract more value from both the businesses that advertise on it and us, the consumers. Whereas, so instead of breaking it up, why don't we just go, it's reached its peak. You know, we, the public, need access to information. Why don't we bring it into public ownership? And then you have the question, what does that look like? Is that nationalization in the old scale? Do you give it to the hands of the state? I don't think so. I don't think we want the state controlling our access to information. So can we bring it into public ownership in a different way? And that comes back to last week's discussion about mutualization and BBC, right? Like, can we bring things into public ownership where we, the public, have control over them, but not through the state? Like, we own it. It's a cooperative. It's like a fan-owned football club like Barcelona or FC United. You know what I mean?
Bring it into the global commons. Love it. Yeah. What do you think, Debs?
Well, you know, I love a commons. But I think it's to talk about. So there are these two cases that are going on. And one is about them having an illegal monopoly in search. And the other one is around an illegal monopoly around the way that they sell adverts. And it's quite technical, but it actually has these big implications. It particularly has big implications for media and is part of some other stuff that we're working on around bringing together independent publishers to try and negotiate with Google and get some money out of them for running an illegal monopoly and making everyone's businesses much harder to run. And I was trying to describe it to someone the other day, and I was trying to explain how I think this illegal monopoly has worked, which is, if you think about an old school newspaper would be supported by advertising revenue. Maybe it's like a local newspaper takes ads from local businesses. That's one side of its business. Then it has a distribution mechanism. So like then it like takes the newspapers out to different shops, and that's how it is sold to people and how the adverts are seen by the public. And of course, you might have some overlap. It might be that some of the shops that stock your newspaper also advertise in the newspaper, but these two parts of the business are separate from each other. The shops aren't, they're not getting to control where the distribution is happening on account of the advertising that they're paying for. Whereas with Google, what you have is the same broker deciding which adverts are going on your page and also how many people are being sent to your page to look at the adverts through the way that they control the algorithms on the search. And that is where you can see that, like, well, this is a mess. Like, how is this going to work? That you have so many opportunities then for Google to extract more and more money, right? Because it's both saying, like, this is your revenue stream, but also now maybe you have to pay us to rise up in the search results for, like, to improve your distribution so that people will come to your page and see your adverts, and then you can get the ad revenue. And at every point in this, Google is taking a cut. And that is part of the reason that it is one of the most powerful companies in the world and why it has so much of an impact on the way that our whole media system works. It's because it's kind of tying together these different parts of the economics. And so, again, there's going to be, I think they have lost the case. Did they lose it last week? It was declared that they did have an illegal monopoly. And so, again, like, the judge is going away. I think this judge is also called Judge Mehta. One of the judges is called Judge Mehta, which is really confusing.
That is absolutely brilliant.
Because it said things in some of the articles like the Mehta judgment. And you're like, hold up, I thought this was about Google. What are we doing here?
But yeah, then they're going to go away and they're going to try and come up with these remedies. But like you're saying, B, like, the remedies are not going to nearly be enough. Whatever they come up with, it's not, I don't think, going to have a significant impact on that kind of market position. That means that it is just very, very difficult to create a viable business out of news and information, even though that is, like, a really important public good. So yeah, I totally think that trying to imagine new models for how Google could run. I think this idea, globalization rather than nationalization is really intriguing. Fuck knows how that would work. But
I was just about to say, like, I would love to have an imagination brainstorm moment of what the fuck would that look like.
I've got a couple of examples actually potentially to think about, but anyways.
Yeah, I mean, you can immediately see a lot of the concerns that we would have of, like, I mean, would we want it to be nationalized by Donald Trump? Probably not. But could it be held, you know, what if Google, the globalization of Google, was actually held by, you know, countries of the global south who are being, well, if you said the countries most affected by climate change are going to be the ones that have most control over how Google works. I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things. Just to come back to one point, which is, what happens to search if you break up Google search into just a lot of smaller versions of Google? If publishers are still having to pay to be seen by you, the consumer, then they're having to produce content for the algorithm of that search engine and optimize it, then Google and the break-off Googles are all still deciding what you see. And they're deciding it based on a very narrow desire to make profit. And very occasionally, in the case of, like, an ideological billionaire like Musk, you know, a desire to divide and rule and spread, you know, atomizing and let's be honest, openly racist, harmful, like, ideas as much as possible. Those are the only two outcomes. There isn't an outcome where, like, a progressive person stewards one of these things, because both that wouldn't make business sense, and also they would be squashed and attacked by the rest of the cartel of smaller Googles that you now have. You know what happens? Like, again, if you had like one railway monopoly and it was one company, you wouldn't then say, well, we'll just make loads of smaller companies running the railway. That's not going to solve the problem. You still got, like, the problem is that everyone needs to use the railway. It's a public good. So everyone should have control over that so that we can sort out the prices and the investment and make sure that all the money's not going offshore, and that we can make sure the services work for the public, not just for, you know, a shareholder, right? Like, and that's what we kind of need to do. Now, in envisioning what it could look like, there's a couple of examples. There is, like, the UN has designated, I think, the first international zone, sort of the first global nature reserve off the west of Australia. It's an oceanic nature reserve because, you know, no one controls those seas. They're not part of any nation's control. But what they're doing is they're designating an area to not be fished, to preserve, like, that area. And so there are already some global initiatives. And weirdly, and the terribly named book by George Monbiot called Age of Consent, which I just hate recommending the book to people, because
age is just a number, baby.
It's supposed to be about, like, he wrote it in about 2005, and clearly he'd been around, like, the anarchist movement that was quite big, obviously looked at the dying liberal and socialist movements in the UK and said, like, their models of democracy clearly everyone hates, but these sort of anarchist or horizontalist ones are not, like, strong enough to actually genuinely create a global democracy, and we need a global democracy. And so he outlines in it, like, how you could create a global democracy. I don't tend to agree with it, but it's about creating a sort of world parliament and using Keynesian economics. But if you want interesting ideas, go out and buy it. Just don't let anyone know, you know, and immediately delete it from your, like, Amazon search results, because I don't think searching, I think he's renamed it as well for the not much better titled A Manifesto for a New World Order. Like, again, not fantastic.
Is that worse? Also, Debs, you immediately made me think of Austin Powers when you said that, the way you said that.
So it's bleak, but there are ideas. But, like, I like the idea, you know, for me, of putting it into a trust where the trust, like, and George Monbiot sort of outlined something similar to this, but not quite this, in his book, where you put global resources in a trust and then directly elect the people who are going to be the custodians of that trust, you know. And again, his suggestion would be on proportional representation, right? Global proportional representation. So, like you said, you get one vote, you get one representative per 10 million people. The UK would get like 6 or 7, right? You know, whereas, like, China would get 100. India would get, you know, India would get 120, you know, like, so, and you're like, oh, okay, that seems like a lot more fair. Like, Nigeria would get, you know, 25, 27 to our 6, you know, like that. So that would be, like, the most comprehensible one. Like, you could try and get into some really, like, dynamic ways of creating it in real direct democracy, or, you know, as some of the writers of the current BBC provisions are talking about, Athenian sortition, which is, like, just juries, randomly selected juries. I would at the moment steer clear of those, because I think those are quite a hard sell to people. We'll just get some random people to oversee Google seems a little bit of a stretch. I mean, you know, I don't know, maybe the results wouldn't be any worse than what we already have. Like, I think that's the argument for sortition.
I keep thinking about a recent thing that happened in my own local area, and the fact that someone kind of brought to the forefront, someone who studied law, how much they disliked juries and how ineffective they thought juries were. But yeah, no, I think after hearing what he had to say about it, I was like, that's really interesting, that perspective, because on a superficial level, I'm like, juries, yeah, people should probably have a say.
There is an interesting question around juries and how they work in terms of, in America, they have elected judges, right? And the judges have a lot less power, which is good, because elections for judges, it turns out, does not a great legal system make. In Britain, we have far more control for the judges, which I'm not a huge fan of, but juries have always been there. Judges really historically come from a place of, they would have been historically the lord of the manor, the local aristocrat, and the juries are supposed to be selected from everyday people. So you could technically, for instance, be guilty of poaching on the lord of the manor's land, right? But because you're being judged by your peers, they say, hey, mate, you were starving. We're going to find you not guilty. And like, that's the sort of basis to it. And I think there's a lot of romance to that. I think also, and I think it's being trialed with citizen assemblies. But I think, you know, I still think in many ways, expanding juries to a lot of areas of civic life is not something people are very familiar with. And so if I was making a case to bring Google into global commons, I probably wouldn't use that yet, just on a persuasive basis, but also because I'm not entirely sure that we've got much evidence of it being the best way to do that kind of thing. We do big mutually owned organizations like Mondragon, you know, like huge cooperatives that are like, you know, that like, you know, there's like 1.1 billion people are members of cooperatives in the world. So like, we have an understanding of what cooperatives are and that they are effective and that they work. And by the way, have a way, way, way lower failure rate than businesses. 80% of businesses fail in the first year, 90% fail in the first 2 years, right?
If you go back to like how where our legal systems came from, you know, this kind of centralization of the state, it was also a centralization of our economic system. So I think there's something about, like, back in the medieval period in the UK, for example, like your town would be run by the guilds, and so it'd be people that worked in particular professions. These would be the kind of forms of self-organization that would, you know, the guilds would do social things. The guilds would build roads, guilds would do policing, guilds would like have a little local prison. So you can kind of see how the jury system would sort of sit alongside that. It's much more on this basis of people sort of coming together and figuring things out. And yes, the kind of the king was someone that you needed to pay taxes to, but actually a lot of the time was quite irrelevant to your day-to-day life unless there was a war, and then you'd have to go and fight for the king or fight against the king or whatever. And there was this really crucial period, I think under Elizabeth I, there was just a lot of centralization that happened in that time. And one of the things that she did in that time was she took away a bunch of powers from the guilds and gave them to the professions. And also kind of outlawed a whole set of self-organization amongst workers that then reemerge with the kind of trade union movements, which kind of like start up in the 1700s. And initially, any form of self-organization by workers was treated as conspiracy. Like, it was treated as like a really terrible thing to do, even though just like a couple of hundred years before, it was actually the basis of social organization, like a crucial part of it. And she gave all this power to the magistrates, basically took power away from the guilds and gave it to the magistrates, who were then much more under the control of the state. And yeah, I mean, this might all seem like a bit of a tangent, but I suppose when we're trying to me, I'm always interested, because I'm interested in commons, how are you thinking about governance of commons? How are you even imagining that it could be possible? And in some ways, like you're saying, the jury system is a bit of a relic, like this idea of being kind of judged by your peers is a bit of a relic of a like more cooperative, self-organized way of doing things. But because it's been attached to the state apparatus and to a system of kind of exclusion and punishment, even to the extent that like if you were being put in a prison in your town, you would be in your town. I'm not saying the prison was nice, but I'm saying that like this thing of you being completely removed from your community, that wasn't like the principle of it. Whereas now, if you're taken to prison, your prison is probably, you know, at least 20 miles, maybe 100 miles from your family. Like the way that you're actually being physically removed from your community, and then of course find it like so much harder to reintegrate. And so then when we're trying to imagine, In so many ways, I always think about things being kind of relocalized or like power returning to much more immediate community spaces. It's quite a stretch and a leap to think about how then that interacts with a global system for dealing with Google. And at the same time, I do think those are some of the crucial questions that we need to figure out, because like you're saying, actually makes much more sense for information to operate as quite a, like a, as a global monopoly. Like that is actually the most efficient and effective way for us to store and access information, is for it all to kind of be in the same system. But yeah, also our like tiny human minds not really, like it's very difficult for us to even conceive of how 7 billion people can coordinate on anything, and how these kind of models of delegation, or this idea of like a jury of your peers, what the fuck does that mean when your peers are like living in such different circumstances and you have no real way of like building relationships with them?
It yeah. makes me think a lot about how a while ago a friend of mine, and this really frustrated me because basically he essentially gave up, if you know what I mean. He essentially voiced that he didn't really have much faith in the world, and I was like, I don't like this. But his point was rooted in this idea of not being able to conceptualize global cooperation when the only kind of like effective cooperation that we seem to at least all generally resonate with and understand on an intimate level is that of our locality or family, you know what I mean? And so since then, I've just been, I can't approach that conversation with him because I'm like, I don't have an idea. I don't know what that looks like. I have ideas, but I don't have anything cohesive. And I don't think we should aim to have anything cohesive either. I don't think that was the point. But it's hard. It's hard to think about.
I think it's the thing that we should be thinking about. I think it's a joyful thing to think about. Like, I think it's wonderful trying to solve big problems, but also to imagine ourselves as one species or one spherical ball, you know, hurtling through the fucking universe. Like, I think that's something beautiful to consider. There's a scientist called Machu Keiku, if I pronounce his name correctly, a Japanese-American scientist, who said, you know, there's these ideas of type one civilizations, planetary civilizations, and then type two is like a stellar civilization, and type three would be a galactic one, I think. That's kind of the term. And he said, we're type zero, on the cusp of becoming a type one, right? And he named these four attributes that he said we have a common music, right? Really interesting, because almost all popular music for everyone around the world is based on the 12 bar blues coming from the Mississippi Delta in the late 1890s, early 90s. Like that, all popular music comes from the same roots. And that's really fascinating, because if you listen to a lot of different cultures' music, they have different tones, different instruments and so forth like that. But recognizably, almost all popular music comes from that. We have a global game, football, which is really interesting. His American mentioned it, not me. We have a global language. The world's second language is English. And that has become, and this is something he said about 15 years ago, this has become more prevalent, not less, in the era of hypercommunication. And he says we have a global communication system, the internet, right? So we actually have a lot of the like the cultural and practical tools to become a global civilization. And actually Google is a fantastic potential test case for what we could create and take into common as a global, as one species. And to think about how we take that into commons would actually might help us think about how we could be a type one civilization, one that sees ourselves as a species rather than as, you know, a variety of things. We have to break down in that process all the power structures and oppressions of everyone within that species to do so, because we cannot be one species. If one person is unfree, we're all unfree, you know, in that arena, in that conception. So it's a beautiful thing to do. So this rather technical case, and Debs and I often deal with like quite technical things now around regulation, but they deal with something that we've cut out, which is around freedom of speech, like what it is and isn't acceptable speech. And that's a huge conversation, and we try and come up with technical solutions. Like, we're now talking about Google. Oh, well, we're talking about legal cases, antitrust laws, you know, blah, 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 right? Like, these are quite technical things, but they open a window into the imaginarium of what we could be as a species and what we could achieve together. And actually, I think in a world where we're constantly sort of doing ourselves down and focusing on the negative and focusing on minutiae and division, like, we should have thoughts like this and use it as an opportunity to imagine things. And yes, say we don't have to have a solution right here, right now, but I could see a world where randomly selected juries do control, oversee the information systems, particularly, by the way, if the information systems are largely automated in the way they run via AI, then maybe you do want a randomly selected jury of people from around the world to oversee how that AI operates rather than technical specialists, or maybe a mixture of the two. Maybe there'd be balances, you know, elected, you know, people who are elected, people who are appointed specialists, and random jury, and you make a mix, you know? Like, I think that's a beautiful thing. That's the kind of thing I like to do in my spare time when I'm not researching an entire segment of the show that's been cut.
Nerd. Oh, fuck, I had a point, but sorry, go on.
There is no better point than nerd.
You distracted me. I had something to say, and then you just said that, and I was like, oh, fuck, now I have to make fun of you.
Yeah, I'm unbearably sincere. Like, for an English person, it's like, it is uncomfortable for everyone else how sincere I am. And then I went to America and I was like, Jesus Christ, this is what I'm like to every other English person. Because like I went there, like they're so unbearably pleasantly sincere that you can't deal with it. Like, they're like, there's no sort of undercurrent of meanness in their communication. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, what's wrong with you people? Why aren't you miserable or pretending to be miserable?
That's just the Brits, babes. That's just the Brits.
I know, and I love our culture. You know, I wanted to respond to your friend who said they kind of lost faith in the idea that people could conceive of community beyond the immediate. That's actually an argument that J.D. Vance recently made and said that it's a Christian idea that you focus on the nearest first and foremost, which is a complete misreading of the teachings of Jesus. But anyways, it's just not true. What was fascinating about global talk and Commonwealth talk and EU talk that came out during that particular period was everyone delighted in seeing people from all over the world. And I immediately saw myself in Chinese people, in Mongolian sheep herders, in Indian people, in Nigeria, like, you know, showing me parts of their world. And we have got, again, this incredible communication system that enables us to see each other as humans in all our beautiful diversity and like difference. And it's very easy, actually, for us to imagine ourselves as part of a global community. It's actually, weirdly enough, that America is such a sinkhole of global conversation that we really struggle to see ourselves as anything other than through the prism of sort of American cultural mores and their prism of looking at the world. And actually, if you took them out of the conversation, I think we might progress more rapidly, maybe.
And also just to say, you know, some of these things seem really utopian about how they could work, and particularly this idea of how is a certain kind of specialist expertise that you might need to engage with these technical questions, how does that fit with sort of sortition or whatever. But then we do also have these models of, you know, Wikipedia is obviously such a good example, just the whole kind of open source kind of tech movement, which is built on kind of these forms of collaboration. And actually a lot of non-monetized collaboration, you know, 20 years ago, that was kind of the basis of a lot of the internet. And a lot of that is still there, right? Like it got bought up by these massive tech companies. But yeah, there is something about tapping into people's desire to share. I remember being on this like message board, I don't know, again, this is really sometime in the 2000s. And it was just this place where people would just ask questions. And they would ask questions on all sorts of things. And actually very quickly, someone with like very specialist expertise would jump in and give them like loads of help. Just in this way that's like, everyone actually does know a lot about their own world and their own sphere. And what if you can tap into that and treat someone as an expert in that way, people will actually kind of show up and really engage and really want to give. So if you kind of see it in that way, because I think part of what we're imagining is so much of the way that people are asked to participate in sort of formal representative processes is really fucking boring. Mm-hmm. Like we've talked about the way that political meetings are structured or whatever. It's just like, oh God, this is so dull. So of course it's like a very specific kind of person that ever does it. But there are ways of doing this which tap into people's creativity, tap into like something about them as an individual, and give them this sense of like the potential of the collective. And I don't know, maybe an AI will come along and just know how to, even for example, running it as a video game. You could really imagine actually how that could work, how global governance of Google could be like a big multiplayer.
Yeah.
And it's all being done in this quite metaphorical way that's really fun, but actually does achieve like consensus results out of it.
That's cool. I like it. And of course, that's what Facebook originally did, was gamify what it did. And Facebook and everything is built, you said it was like quite a bit of the internet. It was the entirety of the internet for the first 20 years. Like my experience of the internet is it, like what happened is very similar to what happened in Britain, which became this capitalist colonialist empire, in England in particular, is an enclosure of the commons. There's like millions of people, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people from around the world just creating knowledge and helping each other out and doing things in common with like no particular structure. And the basic precept, the basic acts that came out were just, let's just help each other do stuff or learn stuff or whatever. And that was like basically the whole internet. And then some people came along and were like, yeah, I wonder how we can make money from this. And they'd been trying for 20 years. And eventually I think Mark Zuckerberg's one of the first ones to really like go, I've got a way of like, I'll take what everyone's already putting in all these forums, but I'll put it in like this enclosed space and I'll offer it for free for several years. And then I'll start charging it to advertisers, to other people. And that is, of course, again, coming back to the word of the year last year, in shitification. It's really about enclosing stuff. It's about saying, actually, you guys don't deserve to have these toys. Let me have it and make loads of money out of it. Do you know what I mean? And control it and control what you see and think. And now we live in a dystopian future.
And not to let Mark Zuckerberg off the hook, but Mark Zuckerberg never made any money. It was Sheryl Sandberg coming in that meant that Facebook started making money. Yeah, yeah, he actually didn't have a plan.
No, that's true. That's a good point, actually. Yeah, someone else.
Sorry, I was making notes. Inshitification is recognized by Grammarly and Google now as a word. Yeah. When I'm typing it on Google Docs, it doesn't do a little underline. If anything, Grammarly told me it has an extra T in there that I forgot to write.
Yeah, I'm not kidding. It was voted, I think it's New York Times Word of the Year for 2024. Like it's genuinely actually recognized.
Part of the dictionary.
And what, by the
and
way,
yet people can't accept pronouns. What the fuck?
We'll all get there. Well, we need to gamify pronouns. That's what we need to do. To
work make out. Them up. You have just, any three-letter word.
We just need little gold stars, okay? Like, I just need to have a little Mario sound of him, like, popping the mushroom or whatever it is whenever I use someone's pronoun correctly, and I do it all the time.
I think you just solved the problem.
I think that's it. Like, yeah, just... resident genius here. Like, I think that's how you get the boomers on board. They love games, actually, surprisingly. But that it goes back to, I remember saying that was said in the 90s by Chomsky, where he said, like, if you ask people to talk about politics, they don't feel very confident about it. And they're either turned off because of their lack of confidence or because it's seen as really boring. But it's often seen as boring because you don't feel like that's a place that you can have an opinion. Ask them about football, right? Like, they will tell you why their owners suck, why the tactics that their team should be using, who they should be recruiting. They've got an in-depth portfolio knowledge of like the finances, like the, you know, the profit loss ratio, you know, they know everything. Like, and they will talk to you for 4 hours, right? Right. And like, so that's what Debs, what's fascinating is what you were saying there, Debs, is that the internet revealed all of those specialisms that people have and the things that are in depth. And actually, democracy, I don't think, should be reduced to like engaging in quote unquote, you know, big capital P politics, right? Like, because like all of our lives are politics and we have developed specialisms and knowledge in all of them. We don't have to constantly sit in flipping council meetings to like be a worthwhile contributor to the demos, to democratic process, which I think leads us nicely to talk about the SWP.
Let's breathe, yeah. And we'll come back.
Do you ever find yourself reading an article and feeling like you're only getting part of the story? Today we're going to talk quickly about sourcing bias. That's right, welcome back to Media Bias 101. I'm your host, Sneaker, and this is the series where we talk about how, yes, the media are always lying to you, but in so many different ways. On a basic level, sourcing bias is exactly what it says on the tin. It's where a publication relies too heavily on sources from a particular area, from a particular industry, or a particular political perspective. It happens on a lot of different levels. You can have sourcing bias within an individual story, you can have it across a particular topic, or you can have it across an entire publication, or our mainstream media as a whole. Examples of this could be articles where only government official sources are quoted, but the communities affected by an issue are not. It could look like a variety of quotes, but all coming from corporations or from specific lobbying groups. It could also look like using a whole range of sources from a whole range of industries, but they've all got the same ideological perspective. Although there are blatant examples of this, the lack of Palestinian voices in news media, the lack of representation of trans-led community groups versus anti-trans campaigners, there are also times where it might not be as black and white. For example, a publication might feature an opposing view, but they might place it further down in the article, or they might use a voice that is not given the same authority and reach as the voices that they are opposing. And this can create something that's called undue weight. For example, I don't know, hypothetically, finding four Twitter users and blaming a Twitter mob as being somehow equally as powerful as the government officials quoted in an article. Something like that. The issue with all of this is it impacts the framing of the issue, and how we understand it can mean omitting important information or important perspectives. And it also continues to reinforce the existing power that the people who are quoted are given. Now, spotting this should be obvious, right? Look for what voices are missing. However, you can break this down by looking at specific aspects of an article. If a headline image is included, who's been featured there? If someone's being quoted in the headline, where has that quote come from? And as you read through the article, at what point is an opposing viewpoint actually being shared? Spotting these patterns again and again helps you to understand the wider media landscape in the UK. Because spoilers, it is not great. If you want to learn more about this, make sure to subscribe to News Club or follow over here, and we'll see you in the next one. Bye!
Right, so next thing up is SWP. Who are the SWP devs?
What I wanted to talk about was actually at the weekend, there was some more like far right protests, quote unquote protests, particularly down in Dover. There were like 200 bikers who went down there. They were doing these anti-immigrant protests. We've got our local elections that are just coming up. So Reform is organizing all around the country. And there was also a counter demo that happened in Dover, and it was organized by Stand Up to Racism, but there were other organizations involved as well, like the National Education Union had people there and things. And I guess I just wanted to talk about Stand Up to Racism and getting involved in anti-racist activism in different parts of the country, where often Stand Up to Racism is going to be the first port of call. They're going to be the most visible organization. To talk a bit about this particular seam of the left, which when you first encounter it can be quite hard. You may well have gone to a Stand Up to Racism thing, maybe gone to a meeting, whatever. And then when you've mentioned that to other people, they've been like, oh no, not Stand Up to Racism. Sometimes it's quite hard to piece together what has happened. So I'm just going to give a little whistle-stop tour through a particular seam of the left in the UK over the last 70 years. So this all hinges on this relationship between Stand Up to Racism and another organization called the Socialist Workers Party, usually called the SWP. The SWP was founded in 1950. It went by a few different names in its early years, settled on the SWP in the 70s. And they come from a kind of left tradition, which is quite focused on sort of top-down hierarchical organizing. So it will be like a very formal structure. There'll be someone who's like the secretary, and then there'll be like people that run the different branches. And if you're coming in as a new member, like I've actually never been to an SWP meeting. I was never recruited by them. But yeah, I think there's a very clear pathway in, and you have a very clear, if you become a proper member of it, it's very clear that you're like at the bottom of the hierarchy, but here's the ways that you could like progress up the hierarchy, which is quite different to the way that lots of other left spaces that I've been in work, where there's at least a story that things are working in a less hierarchical way, that decisions are made by consensus.
Emphasis on story.
Yeah, it's also problematic in lots of ways. But yeah, there's a kind of distinction between these different left traditions. And the SWP has always been small, and it's always practiced something called entryism, where it tries to kind of take over bigger organizations. And so there've been lots of different examples of this. They've often had relationships with trade unions and trade union councils. So for example, I've been told that one of the local trade union councils near me in South Yorkshire is kind of SWP run. Yeah, they've got this strategy of, they've sometimes infiltrated big charities, like War on Want for a while was kind of controlled by people that were involved in the SWP. It is no longer. And I guess they've got, it kind of creates this weird feeling of like there's these shadowy forces going on, where sometimes an organization will be affiliated with them, sometimes it won't. I think part of the problem of it is that it reproduces this left culture of like people that are on the in, people that have the knowledge, people that know what's going on, and then a new person coming in can like find it very hard to figure out. In terms of their public facing work, you'll probably have seen the SWP. What they're very, very good at is showing up to other people's protests, setting up a stall, handing out a bunch of placards with their name on it when they've done absolutely no organizing for it whatsoever. I remember they've been doing this for such a long time. I was reading an interview with someone involved in housing activism in East London in the 1970s, complaining about this exact thing, that the SWP just kept showing up, like putting their branding all over it, but not actually doing any of the work. So what they do much better than a lot of other parts of the left is that they really focus on recruitment. Like they actually do try and talk to new people, and they actually try and bring them into their organization and give them a job to do. It's just that the job is sell our newspaper, hand out our placards, man our stall, rather than like anything actually useful. It's like there's a lot of you're bringing people in, you're making them feel useful, but all they're doing is actually like building and maintaining the structure of the organization. So that's kind of the SWP.
It sounds like a multi-level marketing scheme when you say that.
It kind of is. Like yeah. It's, or you could say multi-level marketing has learned a lot from these sorts of structures.
Yeah. Interestingly, the SWP's printing press is owned by one family and always has been. So essentially what you've got is like its height around in about 2010, you had about 15 to 20,000 people working for free to sell this family's papers. Like that's what they were doing.
Yeah, I did not know that, but that does not surprise me. Anyway, the SWP has always had a complicated reputation, but in particular in 2013s, allegations became more publicly known about kind of rape and sexual harassment happening within the organization. And in lots of ways, this is entirely predictable. It is a top-down hierarchical organization dominated by men, and where if you get really like into the structure of it, what they'll do is they'll move you around the country. They'll like post you somewhere, be like, go and sell newspapers in, I don't know, Scunthorpe, go and sell newspapers in Wigan. And so they'll kind of separate you off from other people that you know. And these are exactly the conditions that are prime for like for abuse to happen. And someone had made allegations, and then there was an internal investigation which exonerated the guy. Lots of people said that was a stitch up. This became more public known. Lots of people left the SWP at that point. And so
a lot then, to be fair, like you know, the majority maybe of the organization, certainly all the young people. It is worth noting that it was a lot. It was like all the youth, wasn't it? And it was like it really broke the organization to my recollection.
Yeah, yeah. And you had lots of splinter groups and stuff and whatever. Anyway, this was also, bearing in mind, around the time that all of the spy cop stuff was really being exposed. And the spy cops had infiltrated the SWP. There were a lot of them in that. So yeah, you have this, again, it's this like atmosphere of suspicion that is both about like, is this person a cop? But also now you've got this the SWP brand had gone so badly, like it was so tainted, that this tactic of entryism and this tactic of setting up front organizations becomes like basically the way that they need to do recruitment. Because if you actually say that you're part of the SWP, people, like there was now a lot that was publicly being known about why they were a problem. And the SWP has always had a strong relationship with a certain kind of anti-racist organizing. The SWP was very much the dominant party in the anti-Nazi League in the 1970s. They also were a big part of setting up the Stop the War coalition around the Iraq War. And they had this organization called Unite Against Fascism, which was very definitely connected to the SWP. And then there's this sister organization that was created called Stand Up to Racism. And it seems like, as an outside observer, it seems like Stand Up to Racism was basically created because both the SWP and Unite Against Fascism had a bad rep. And now Stand Up to Racism is probably the most well-organized national anti-racist network that there is. And so if you're in a place like I am in Sheffield, like all of the counter demos against the fash when they were marching in Rotherham and stuff, they're always being called by Stand Up to Racism. And now you have this problem, which is Stand Up to Racism the SWP or not? And I guess I would give a nuanced answer in my view, which is definitely its roots and history come from the SWP. Definitely there are people in leadership in both of those organizations. And particularly, for example, someone local here who's very involved with Stand Up to Racism here was part of the group in the SWP who exonerated the guy, were part of that investigation, exonerated the guy accused of sexual assault. So there are these very direct links, but also there are definitely lots of people in Stand Up to Racism who are not SWP. For example, Diane Abbott is the chair, and I don't think she is SWP. She's clearly Labour hard or die, no, ride or die. What you can end up with is this kind of culture of, like I say, this suspicion and also this like guilty by association thing, which is really, really toxic in the left. For example, sometimes people will say, oh, that person spoke at a Stand Up to Racism rally. Well, we can't deal with them because they're SWP. And particularly because Stand Up to Racism, like the SWP, is actually quite good at recruitment, actually put some effort into it. And so often what they'll do is they'll recruit, especially like young black and brown people who are first coming into activism. Stand Up to Racism is often the first place that they will land, the first people that will bring them in and give them a job to do and platform them and, yeah, give them some political structure and education and stuff. And I don't think it's true to say that those people are the SWP. And actually, a very common thing is that people are in Stand Up to Racism for a while, and then they're like, oh, I've noticed that there are some things about the way this is organized that I don't really jive with, and then they'll move on to something else. And I think it's a real problem if you go in with this really hard line, I can't do anything with Stand Up to Racism, I can't go to anything organized by them, can't like talk to or work with or organize with anyone who's part of Stand Up to Racism. You just end up in this like this bind that is also... Part of the reason it's a problem is that if you go into Stand Up to Racism, what they will tell you there is everyone else in the left is really factional. Everyone else in the left, we're the ones that actually believe in unity. And you're going to go around, and because you're involved with us, people will tell you that you're like a dickhead and that you're part of rape culture and that, you know, and that's not what we're doing. And that won't be what their experience is of Stand Up to Racism as well, like at least in the immediate. And so you actually perpetuate this like divisive, yeah, this divisive culture and this culture of suspicion. And really the way to deal with it is to out-organize them. And this has actually been done pretty effectively in London with lots of groups and organizations being like, you need to come together and you need to call the protest first. Mm. When the fascists are marching, you need to be really on it and call the counter demo before Stand Up to Racism do. And then Stand Up to Racism will come to your demo. And of course, the SWP will also come to your demo. They will hand out their newspapers and their placards. But at least there's like some way that you're saying they're not the only organizing force. And now if they say this is our thing and not your thing, they're the ones who are splitting left. They're the ones who are being divisive. But yeah, I know this is like quite a long story, but it has literally been a long story. It's been going on for like 75 years. And no one has yet found... like a real solution to this, because the SWP have not gone away. They've not died. Stand Up to Racism in some ways are like, they're probably in a big growth moment right now because there's a big growth in the fash, and like there's a real need for anti-racist organizing, and the relationship between the two is definitely there and also like murky and cloudy. And yeah, we basically, if you think that there needs to be anti-racist organizing going on which is not allied to the SWP, then you kind of, you need to make that happen. Actually, you need to get together with some people and be like, what is this other thing that we're going to do? How are we going to be the ones calling the demos? How are we going to be sort of changing the space of anti-racist organizing in our area?
I agree. It's still okay though to be annoyed with them. Like that, it's difficult because they've been like the most significant left-wing political organization in my life for 25 years of activism, right? Like, and particularly when I first came into activism around Stop the War, right, which they were just utilizing as a big recruitment tool. And what you realized is like they have no theory of change. I mean, entryism really isn't a theory of change. Like, we'll take over big organizations, we'll set up front groups, right? And you realize they just do that with everything. Anything that's big, they'd move on to Palestine, they'd move on to, you know, they tried to do anti-globalization environment, but you know, the movements were better organized in those areas. So they set up things like globalized resistance during the anti-globalization movement. And it was big, but they couldn't do what they did with movements like Stop the War. So then what happens in my early formative activist years is you make it your mission to ensure that you do whatever you do better than them and get there first. When the student movement happened in 2010, everyone was like, we're going to call the occupations. The Socialist Workers Party tried to occupy lots of student places after the initial riots. And they did in some cases, and people took them off them. Or for, like in Leeds, there was two separate occupations, the SWP one and the other one. Like there was open fighting, sometimes physical fighting, like because it was so determined from, you know, stop the wars happened in 2003 to about 2006. And they proved themselves to have absolutely like the SWP, they have no strategy, they have no tactics. Their only purpose was to recruit. So all they would do once they have recruited and they've got stop the war going, and they've taken control of it, is call more demonstrations because they're not interested in doing anything else. They just want demonstrations at which they can sell papers and put up placards. If you look at, by the way, the Stop the War demonstrations, 2 million people, they're almost all carrying Socialist Workers Party placards, right? And that's all they're interested in doing. They're just a marketing agency, right? Like they're just a paper selling organization. But what I used to say to the environmental movement is, like, you can hate them, but you guys don't like talking to people. You know, why was the first organization I was in at 15 the SWP? It was. I was in the SWP when I was 15. Right. I also left when I was 15 because I'm not a fucking idiot. But like, you know, that was spent, I was recruited in and had some political meetings that I was not particularly interested in because they were doing a demonstration in the center, city center of Leicester. No one cares about Leicester. Do you see any like left wingers in Leicester or Hull or Peterborough in the city center every weekend with a stall saying this is wrong, this is wrong, picking the topic of the week, getting you to sign a petition, and then calling you up and saying, here's some papers, would you be up for selling them, would you be up for coming to our meeting, here's some tasks, right? Like, and I was like 15 trying to sell Socialist Workers papers at my school in like a pit village in Leicestershire, right? And they would send them out to me, and I got overwhelmed. I was like, you've got to stop doing this. Also, I went to some meetings, I was like, I don't think I jive with your politics, you know. We would get so angry at them, like the environmental movement in particular, like at that time, and the anti-globalization, this sort of horizontalist movement that was extremely strong in its own way and was incredibly focused on direct action, probably all tactics and no strategy, right? Like, and I was like, how are we getting anyone into the movement? Like at the time, it was just osmosis. Whoever was around on the scene in clubbing or squatting, right, it'll sort of get sucked into what we were doing. I was like, why do we never do stalls? Why do we never do flyers? Why do we never publish anything? Like, you know, this is sort of pre-internet or really it being widely used. So why do we never have any printouts of what we stand for or believe, or like, you know, to get people on board? It's like, no, it's all about action. And so we had that failing as well. And I found like a lot of the critique of the SWP really frustrating because I was like, no, my inclination is to do what they're doing, but do it for a purpose. Because the SWP have no theory of change, but they do have a theory of recruitment, and it's really fucking effective. It's really good. Like, it's really good. They're just there. They're just always there. And they'll find the movement at the moment. They tried it with Black Lives Matter. It didn't quite work. Also, they do what like you see in most movements, right? Like a lot of activists that are doing really interesting things now went through Extinction Rebellion, right? People gravitate to movements that are not perfect, but they are the big thing in the moment. And a lot of people come through Stand Up to Racism. And Stand Up to Racism was largely formed really as a front group to take in trade union money, because the trade unions can openly support a Socialist Workers Party organization. And in my trade union, the Socialist Workers, in their entryism, they always try and make the treasurer of every branch a Socialist Workers Party member. Because then when the treasurer says, yeah, we've got enough money in the coffers, does everyone want to donate to Stand Up to Racism? No one in the branch is going to go, no, I don't think we should give money to an anti-racist organization. So they take all the money from the trade unions to pay for their full-timers who work in Stand Up to Racism, which is another thing that you hate. But I only hate it because they're ineffective. Like, if they were effective, if they actually had a strategy or a theory of change, you might like accept it, but they don't. They only have a theory of recruitment. But the final point, and I'll leave it this, the thing that I really thought was interesting is I met a comrade from Toulouse who, like, basically what he would do, what his crew would do, is go along to SWP meetings, which are usually very well attended. They'll go around postering up on bins and stuff like that. And they'll like, why Marx was right, or why Chomsky is wrong, or why we need to resist the occupation, or whatever it is. And a bunch of people go along, about 30 people maybe, and they're all interested. And so what he would do is go along, ask some awkward questions, and then flyer everyone on the way out. So he used their work to recruit. Like, he was like, they're doing all the recruiting. Well, great. They've got everyone in one place. It's now shooting fish in a barrel. You found all the interesting people. So do to the SWP what they tried to do to all the big movements, which is go along to their shit and say, we've got something better going on. But that does mean you've got to have something better going on.
You know what I think is really interesting is that both of you have used the word jive. And that to me right there is a generational difference.
And literally, as I said it, I was like, this is a very old school word.
But when you said it, I was like, okay.
It's like a dagger to the heart. But I just picked it up from Debs. And by Debs, a monkey see, monkey do. That's not in my vernacular usually.
It isn't. It was the first time I ever heard that come from me.
It is like, occasionally. Wow,
that really sat with you in the way that it sat with me. And now I have to use it, don't I?
Yeah, I think it's a good word.
Me and a friend were trying to come up with a protest bingo card. And one of the things on it was always the like SWP placard with the SWP ripped off.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, yes, 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 yes. I remember we used to do a bingo for meetings when we were, because it was actually kind of funny, actually, kind of like being in youth organizing, because there was a lot of like kind of, I think, resentment towards adults in certain organizing spaces, justified or otherwise. And so some people started to create a bingo card where you'd sit, if you ever did or were in a call with adults, you would, and especially like NGO type adults, you would essentially start to cross off all like this, the NGO speak and all the like, it was so funny. It's like, because I mean, for me, that was, I think that's something that came quite beautiful from youth organizing, which was like a mockery of like ineffective adult organizing.
Very mockable. Like one of the things I find most mockable about the SWP is they're very good. They're very obsessed, not good. They're obsessed with statements and positions. And it's a really archaic, like left-wing thing. You see it a lot in Europe, a lot more than the UK now. But like their whole thing is once you've entered an organization, it's to try and force that organization to take political positions and push their political agenda along. Again, it's not entirely not a strategy, but it kind of mostly is, because at best, what they do is they get like this mealy-mouthed sort of committee-drawn statement to be said by some trade union flunky, like in a press release that no one ever reads. Like, and that will have been like 6 months worth of political work, you know, to get them to say like, you know, something like, we should be fighting for the minimum wage of £15 for everyone or something like that. It's not even that. They'd have said, it's something even more, it'd be more obscure, right? And at least the Socialist Party, who are not the Socialist Workers Party, their entryism was, they were called the militant tendency, their entryism was into the Labour Party. So at least they were trying to take control of a party that controlled the state. I don't think that's right. I don't want to control the state. It doesn't really end well for anyone. At least it's like a theory of change you can kind of understand. But again, they were just very obsessed with statements and winning like very minor political battles at the yearly annual conference. That's where socialists shine, annual conferences. They have this particular technique, by the way, watch out for it if you're ever in their spaces, which is they'll usually have the chair or someone on the panel will be from the SWP, and the chair will call on someone either from the crowd or on the panel to say something, and suddenly people start getting up and applauding it. And what happens is the SWP put people throughout the room at the beginning. I knew them all, and they'd sit them spaced around the room. So then people would get up all around the room and seem to be spontaneously clapping. So you'd go, okay, I guess that's what we're doing, right? Like, and you politely join in, and some people really get into it, right? Like, and it's a way to, like, pre-internet, this is a way to manipulate a room of people, right? Like, and they've got loads of techniques, and they teach you those things. Like, that's your political education. It's like, here's how to have the right position on everything, which is read the weekly paper, which will tell you the right position on everything. We're against NATO, we're for this, don't think for yourself. And then take those positions into every discussion that you have, right? And often there was like there's a party set up by George
Galloway, respect.
Respect. And I joined that for my sins. They put the SWP, who I worked semi-closely with, put me on the executive because like I was like a token. That's what they do with Stand Up to Racism. They're like, look, it's not a Socialist Worker Party organization because we put people who are not at all affiliated to us. And they would ask, they'd be like, right, you need to take this position. I'm like, mate, I'm not in your party. I'm not going to do that. And they're like, well, we've all caucused and agreed. And I'm like, not in your party, right? Like, I'm not going to, I didn't caucus. And I said, what was the vote? And he said, it was like, you know, it was 9-8, this position. And they'd taken this position that they wouldn't allow a second councillor to run. They said, we're going to run in Rusholme and not Cheetham Hill. 9-8, they decided. And then they bullied the room using those techniques and other techniques. A lot of people who joined Respect were just random people who were against the war, right? Like there are just lots of people into voting against running for a second council in Cheetham Hill. But if you know anything about Manchester, North Manchester, South Manchester is incredibly divided. Their idea was people come from North Manchester to come and help the South Manchester person, who, by the way, was the SWP person, right? People didn't do that. Of course they didn't. They're not traveling from Cheetham Hill to Rusholme. You know, like you're not catching two buses to do stuff. So let people do. They had, you know, 50 people in the room who wanted to support a local council, 50 people running in a council election. You might have got a council elected. And what it reminded me of is that they make their decisions and act in a unanimous fashion, even if like there's a very slim majority. But once the majority is decided, they act as one. And I'm not necessarily saying, by the way, that that's a bad thing. It's a bad thing if you have bad tactics and bad strategy, which they do. Maybe it is a good thing, but I've never seen it work well in practice. It's one of those things that sounds like it'd be good, but whenever it happens, whenever you meet these kinds of organizations that operate that way, it's always the majority decision, even if it's very slim, it's always to do something really stupid. And so you think, well, that can't be a good way to make decisions then. And that's what kind of made me fall more in love with consensus at the time. I was like, you're more likely to get something that, because we all agree with it, it's probably a better idea. And when we all act on it as one, we all truly believe it, you know, rather than this kind of thing. So there's lots of lessons from them, but there's a great joke, but it's not a great joke, it's a terrible joke. It's a Mark Steele joke that was said during the era, which is the biggest party on the left are ex-members of the SWP. I don't think, like, and the reason for that is that's your first point. I was there when I was 15. Everyone I knew had joined the SWP at some point. I think it should be celebrated that people joined the SWP, and it should be celebrated that they're wanting to join the movement and find something useful to do. And then it should be celebrated the fact that you can go and find them very easily. You know where they are. You can go along to their meetings and say, hey, it's great that you're up for doing something about racism. Would you like to do something better than what these guys are doing? Cool. Come and join us.
Yeah, it's interesting. The bit of the environmental movement that was my route into activism in the late 2000s, the SWP had no presence. Mm. So the way that I encountered the SWP was actually through Counterfire, which was there was a
breakaway
kind of purge of people from the SWP in 2010. And those people set up this splinter group, Counterfire, which some people uncharitably said was like the people that were like too shit for the SWP. But I actually, my experience of the crew that I met was really positive. And what they were doing was running these kind of cultural events. The first one I went to was called Love on Trial. And then we did one like Sex on Trial. And we did like, and they were just an interesting mix of political discussion, but also, you know, you'd have some music and you'd have some performances. And yeah, there was quite an interesting way of, I really remember one of the people very drunk, like describing it's like, I guess it's like part of a Gramscian hegemonic project.
Talking about like NGO bingo, the Leninist, you know, Lenin, because they, by the way, they're Marxist Leninists, the SWP. Like the Leninist bingo that you can do is incredible. It's all about referencing like dead white men, like, and using their name with a shun on the end or ist as like to one up the other person to show that you have more in-depth arcane knowledge of like dead Russians to base your revolutionary theory around. And praxis, the word praxis comes out a lot. I love that one. That's a real treat. That's the kind of thing that eventually drives people out more than that they're shit at what they do is their language. Like someone pointed this out, I think it was Aaron Bastani pointed out that like a lot of the Marxist Leninist texts were last translated in the 1920s. So you speak with this really archaic, like 1920s English that's translated directly from Russian or German or Latin. It just makes you sound like a fucking weirdo. Like they just sound like weirdos. Sorry.
But yeah, I mean, it was actually a really important political space. It met and understood a bunch of things because I hadn't come in through Stop the War. I didn't really understand the ripple effects. I didn't really understand what had happened with Stop the War Coalition. I didn't really understand what had happened with Respect. And yeah, it was an important place for me to understand things. And I think that the events that we ran were good. Like they were fun. They were interesting. And it definitely wasn't that my experience of that bit of Counterfire was not this like top-down hierarchical thing. It was very much the kind of more consensus-based decision-making. But maybe that's just because I was in the like cultural arm and not trying to make we weren't coming up with position statements or anything.
No, I think Counterfire were actually very good. I know a few of them. They ran the People's Assembly, which was really the movement that built Corbynism, right? So for years, the People's Assembly Against Austerity was kind of like, after sort of 2012, again, they'd done what the SDP is very good at doing, is like creating or utilizing a popular moment or popular feeling about a particular thing and putting loads of people together in one place. And they were a lot less stringent about like trying to recruit people into Counterfire or taking positions or winning party lines. I think that's probably why you don't see much of Counterfire any longer, though they still exist and People's Assembly is still there. And they're still adjacent to Corbynism. You know, actually, one of the worst things that happened because of Corbynism is a lot of people moved from that into the Labour Party and they stopped creating the public pressure outside of Parliament because they were too busy trying to win debates within the Labour Party. And actually, that's kind of what destroyed the anti-austerity movement, was Corbyn winning. But in a way, he was, you know, a product of their capable organising. So actually, I have a lot of sympathy for Counterfire as an organiser. And they were a lot more like, you know, like, let's engage in lots of different things and we'll do some cultural things and music. And, you know, like, I've got more warm and fuzzies about them, you know.
This has been a long, long conversation. I've enjoyed it because you guys, this is your area of expertise. Let's be so honest.
There's a lot of wounds associated with the SWP. Like, there's a lot of heartache, you know.
For all of less than a year? Or do you just mean the info? Like,
no, because like when I came into the movement in 2003, they dominated everything for the first 3-4 years of my political life. But, you know, 2007 is when I really became part of a movement that had managed to break away. Because even the environmental movement, it's all circling. You know, but the center of gravity, a bit like the cultural center of gravity of the world is the US, the center of gravity in the activist movement was physically the SWP. They had the stalls, they had the meeting rooms, the big meetings, the big demos, right? Like, and particularly they had Stop the War, which was the most important movement of our lifetime. A lot of people don't talk about it as a movement, weirdly, because they talk about like a 2 million person march and then that's it, because of course it achieved so little. But, you know, in my lifetime, still to this date, I've never been part of a movement that had as wide public support as this movement, right? Like, and felt so urgent. You know, imagine if Britain hadn't joined the war with America. Imagine what a significant departure that, and if European nations hadn't, right? Like, the path of imperialism would have still been taken by America, but alone, you know, the fact that a people's movement could have potentially won. And it was like a very close vote in Parliament. It was only carried by the Conservatives, you know, to go to invade Iraq. Like, all those lives that could potentially be saved. And we all agreed on something. We all came out for it. And so I can personally, you know, emotionally never forgive them, even though intellectually I like see that there's a real value in what the SWP do by accident. Emotionally, I can't forgive them because the most important movement of my life was destroyed by them, by their lack of tactics, strategy, by their self-serving obsession with recruiting, and by their sort of weird anachronistic language and their like very insular cultish behavior. Like, they would literally sit on separate tables and they would recruit people, young people, like immediately 18-year-olds, and pull them onto separate tables in the pub, and then they would have rules within the party. You're not allowed to date people outside the SWP. You know, everything is about the party. You know, living in and next to that, but like when you're like from the age of like 20 to 24, like, I'll never, you know, it will always be way bigger part of my life than probably anyone else's. But also, they're growing again, so it is a big discussion, you know.
And what actually, okay, bringing back to like what people can do, what should you be getting involved with, you know? Who do you go to after you've encountered Stand Up to Racism? Who's doing good shit right now?
I would check out the Anti-Fascist Network, AFN. You can check them out online. So they're like a sort of decentralized autonomous network of like, you know, sort of radical anti-fascist groups. I think also if you're in Stand Up to Racism, you know, there's a lot of difficulty about what targets they're picking. Like, having a demonstration in the center of multicultural Manchester about reform just feels cool. So maybe you should be trying to encourage them to pick better targets, you know, and be in more difficult places instead of recruiting students and black and brown people and using them as cannon fodder against the fash. Maybe people should be encouraging them to do the difficult organizing in the areas that the fash are recruiting. Again, they won't do that because they're not interested in that. They're interested in easy recruitment. It is basically your marketing scheme. But yeah, I would look at the anti-fascist network and also getting with your buddies and making something happen, you know. Start off with maybe something cultural, you know, something that brings people together, and then get people in a room. This is something I'll always keep coming back to. Get people together, plots and plans will occur. The biggest like trick the state and the powers that be have to keep us oppressed is by making us not spend time together. So even if you do nothing else, even if the AFN isn't for you or something like that, get together, do a gig, an art showing, a drama show, play some footy, some cricket, get a club together, get a crew, but stay. This is an, like, maybe do it as an anti-fascist fundraiser for like particular, you know, anti-fascist causes or whatever, and keep doing those things and bring people together. People, once in the room, they'll come up with plots and plans and then support them. You know, that's the best route. That's always going to be the best route. If there isn't anything there, get people together, see what comes out of that.
Yeah, I think that's really right. And also coming, like you said, coming to the Stand Up to Racism demo with a flyer for something else that you're doing. Because there will be lots of people there who are not part of the organization, or and also because they can be quite controlling around the presentation of the thing or whatever. Like at the demo that we had in Sheffield last year, which I think again is, you're totally right about this like lack of strategy. There was the FASH had said that they were going to march in Sheffield, and they'd also said they were going to march in Rotherham, and Stand Up to Racism called a counter demo in both places, and loads of people came to the Sheffield one, hardly anyone went to the Rotherham one, and the Rotherham one was the really big one, which on reflection should have been obvious.
Yeah.
And lots of us were really kicking ourselves afterwards of being like, because the target in Rotherham was a hotel with housing asylum seekers, whereas the target in Sheffield was just like the city centre, like the town hall. And also because Rotherham is exactly the kind of place where they're going to have more success in recruiting. It's exactly those sort of like smaller cities and towns rather than like one very dominated by the university like Sheffield. So I do think that that was partly, that was on all of us that were trying to figure out what to do at that time. But then also at the Stand Up to Racism demo in the centre of Sheffield, there were a bunch of young black and brown kids who were there and who were taking a more, like they were up for a fight in a good way, I would say, like an energy that needs to be like harnessed and supported. But how are you making sure that those people then don't like get in massive trouble with the police, or that like they're going to be cared for if they have injuries or whatever? But there was definitely an attitude amongst some people in the crowd trying to basically kind of tone police them in a way that's like, well, I just think that's not the way to deal with this. Like they're angry and they should be, and this energy is actually an important energy, but they need care, right? Because if they're not brought into a kind of wider network of people who, like, for example, know how they can get a lawyer, or like there is actually a set of like movement infrastructure, like for example Green and Black Cross, these you know, who will provide legal support for people, but like new people coming in often don't have any idea that any of that exists. And so quite often what you'll end up with is people who are both the target of the FASH and also the main target of the police can end up like facing really, really serious consequences for like standing up for themselves and standing up for their communities when they could have been connected into this movement infrastructure. Maybe they could have got a lawyer and the lawyer could have told them, just say no comment, and maybe they would have been fine. So yeah, I think there's something about, for example, showing up to protests obviously with bus cards. So bus cards have information about what to do if you're arrested, and Green and Black Cross kind of distribute these bus cards. And I think they who knows how much use they have ever been. but I think there will always be people, like I always remember this guy who was out in the student protests in 2010, and he threw a stick at the police lines, and we're in a context where like loads of stuff was going on, and he was arrested and he was asked, did you throw that stick? And he said yes, and then he ended up in prison. And if he had just said no comment, probably nothing would have happened to him, because it would have been extremely difficult for them to prove that he had thrown it. But because he said yes, he ended up with a prison sentence. And that's the kind of level of like, that's the stuff that I worry about now as like a kind of slightly older person who's seen these movements come and go. That's the stuff that I worry about, is like the people coming in, and then who is, what's their port of call? What are they docking into? Because like you say, the most immediate thing they're going to dock into is SWP or an SWP related organization, who are not actually going to be the ones that are going to support them in community defense, because they've got their own idea of like what the strategy should be, and it's often like stupid. And they're also not going to be the ones who are actually like helping take care of them if they end up needing legals, needing healthcare.
The broader point, like, which is that like when different energies turn up, there is tone policing at demos, and it's embracing those different energies and making sure that they're provided support by looking at organizations that provide support for varieties of people, including green and black and things like that. So even if you haven't got an event or anything going on, you can look at a website like Green and Black Cross or other things that do protest support and stuff, and you can print out their stuff and bring that along and give that to people and just make sure that they're looked after and that they're looking after themselves, because the SWP are not going to look after them. They're not going to look after anyone who's not being recruited into their organization and is acting exactly in the way that they want them to. And so, you know, it's worth making some people aware of that.
Yeah, and you can do legal observer training. There's a need for lots of different roles in the fight against fascism, including people that are doing this kind of more support, like being available to do arrestee support after demos, which is not like, you're not condoning any illegal activity that might have happened. But you are saying that like, people get released from a police cell at 3 a.m. and they don't have their phone and they don't have any money. Like that can be this like really, it can be a really traumatizing and isolating experience, especially for people that have turned up to a demo, not really knowing anyone, not being part of a group, getting nicked unexpectedly and then getting released in a context where they're like really stuck. Them coming out and they're being arrestee support there, someone that can help them get home, someone that can like link them in with, you know, how to get their stuff back from the police, can be the difference between someone coming to a demo and then becoming part of a movement and someone coming to a demo and then being like, fuck that noise, I'm never doing that again.
Yeah. There's also other great support roles, like there might be local community kitchens to you that back in the day, it used to be a regular feature that if there was a big demo, a community kitchen would turn up, you know, with food or maybe even a mobile kitchen. Now less so, but if you're near one, particularly groups like Food Not Bombs, you could encourage them to go to demos because food, water, medical support, legal support, vibes, can you bring a sound system? Can you bring some tunes? You know, like there's stuff that you can do. If you're in a crew or you've got a hobby and that crew's up for doing stuff against racism, bring them down to the demos as well and bring your own homemade like banners and tunes or whatever it is that you create as well. You know, come in your like sport team uniform or, you know, like doing things as a crew. You can use these as opportunities to do things as a crew or to provide support or to get involved in a different way. So, you know, for the force SWP, they do provide those spaces where we come together. And then maybe you could even have, like, you could say to yourself, we're just going to go around and see if we find some sound people and say, hey, do you want to meet at the pub at 5 o'clock afterwards or 6 o'clock afterwards or the friend's meeting house or a cafe? Because we're just going to hang out and chat about what next, you know, because lots of people end up coming there, hear a few speeches, and the first thing they ask is, what next? Right. And then if you're with the SWP, it's come to our branch meeting, start selling some papers. But most people aren't going to do that. And then they do disappear out of the movement. So if you can go around and say, well, we don't know what next, but we have got a place to hang out where we could all chat about what next.
I love everything you're saying because it's reminding me of what my experience of protest and activism has been and how disappointed I am at the present moment. Activism that I've seen so far is so shit. And it's sad because I think so much of it does come from the fact that, like, I think it would be true to say as well, when I was getting involved, there was this complete disconnect from everything that happened before, right? Like, Debs, you mentioned the fact that, like, you've been able to witness these waves of people, of young people, of change, and then being part of one of those waves. I'm very grateful I was connected to a national network that was actually in contact with, and this is the thing, right? There was always a lot of London hate, but the Londoners were the ones that fucking knew what was up. I'm sorry. They knew what was happening. They were a lot more,
how
like...
How dare you?
I know.
How very dare you?
I know. But
Manchester
they knew...
crew would not have that at all.
Manchester, at least from my
experience.
From my experience, I'm sorry.
It's become a liberal
playground. It is liberal as fuck, liberal as fuck. And so we were, and so genuinely wasn't until I was in contact with more Londoners or like London activists that I was like, oh, this is the things we do. Oh, this is what you mean by legal training. Oh, look at, like, you know what I mean? And it's a shame that it was like also part of this kind of like a lot of resentment again towards this like centralization of like people and activism in London. That was a whole other thing.
But the good thing is that London is becoming increasingly unlivable, and so all the activists are leaving.
Yeah, yeah. And they're scattering to the four winds. And, you know, actually, that should be a topic for another thing, which is what do we do about this scattering of the people around the country, and how do we form a network and stay together?
And how do we communicate intergenerationally? Because for me, that was a big thing, especially when you're in spaces where it's like you're intimidated by adults, or spaces where you actually don't like these adults, you think they're stupid. I don't think that's productive.
Also, there's been like progressively these bigger gaps between the waves in the movement, and particularly lockdown created this 2-3 year gap, this generational black hole that has like lost a lot of skills there. The other thing that really lost a lot of skills was like the ban on squatting. Like it disabled there to be spaces where people just hung out and learn again, just by osmosis, just by hanging out with other people, how to do stuff. Right. And it not just got rid of a culture, but like, you know, skills and learning. So, which is a culture really, actually, it's a way that you pass on skills and learning, I guess. But one way that everyone can do this is by listening to this podcast and sharing it with a friend.
Exactly. I think it's really valuable. It's also why I wanted to do this. It's also why this conversation is way, like, way longer than the usual one, because I think some of the best stuff does come from able to, like, really interrogate things. And I look forward to every episode that follows this, because you guys are so precious to me. Like, you mean so much. Like you really do. Because it means that I'm able, literally a few days ago, I was having a coffee with a friend. I don't drink coffee. We both drank tea, actually. And it kind of came out, right? The podcast, like, talking about things, because they actually asked me about a protest that we both been to, and this is kind of where my earlier criticism came from. And that's when I started ranting, and I was like, but if I just show you this podcast, and if you just listen to the podcast, then everything I've just said will be said better by two other people that have been in the movement for way longer and have way more insight and have way more to say about like consistent patterns of things that have been happening and effective ways of organizing, which I'm going to summarize right here and say friendship and love. That's what I got. Doing things with your friends and caring about people is what I got from that. So yeah, there we go.
This is where you'll get to build the revolution every week. Listen to Got News with us. And let's encourage some people to like chuck in some questions, because then we can go off for an hour on their questions instead of our own navel gazing. I'm sure people have got like more like nuanced or immediate questions than what we've covered here. But it's a good start for 10, isn't it? Can I also mention at the end of the podcast that we cut out an entire segment? We sort of half started a segment. We cut out a segment about kneecap. So, and that's not for time purposes, though in the end that has worked out for the best. That's because freedom of speech is a tricky so-and-so in the modern day and age. And when we work out how to traverse it, we will. Until that point, we don't think it's important. We do. We just don't know how to publicly, on a recorded platform, talk about it in a way that doesn't get us in a lot of trouble. So, like,
yep.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for your words. Thank you for speaking. And we'll catch you next time. Keep listening.